shell appears strong, but the inside is rot. It's time to be stirred. The time is now. The winds have changed. Read the signs. No time to hide. The winds have changed.
Millennia ago, from the little cave on the tiny island of Patmos in the Aegean Sea, the heavens opened. Since then, the world has been fascinated by the cosmic upheaval brewing on the horizon of history. The upheaval is now upon us. It is within us. To some degree, it always has been. But there has been a sudden and violent shift in the affairs of the world. The winds have changed. Heaven will not be silent. Let's now join Father Anthony Bush, pastor of St. Stanislaus Kostka, the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy in Chicago, and author of A Mother's Plea, For the Winds Have Changed. Together we can pave the way for a hopeful response to the signs of our times.
Hey, welcome everyone. God bless you for tuning in to The Winds of Change. It's Wednesday. It's brain wrinkling time. That means Father Kois is here with you. And glad you can tune in. We will do some...
You just wrinkle my brain.
Brain wrinkling. Yes, and I'm going to take a little curveball. I like to let you, my listeners, realize that I'm a many-faceted person. And I'm going to take a side road away from the usual historic... Well, yeah, I know that sometimes disappoint. We'll get back to it, no doubt about it, but... I felt called. Maybe it's because I had two weddings over the weekend, and thinking about weddings and all that. And actually, when I do read history and I do try to trace the narratives that have changed history, the topic of marriage often is a deeply rooted element of events of history, but it's often missed. It's often not seen as that significant, but it really should be seen as significant as people do celebrate their weddings and with justifiably grandeur. And there are few things in life that receive the attention of a marriage, of a wedding, as do those. Wedding vows. And because there's so many young people that don't seem to see the importance or the need for getting married in church, especially even Catholic young people, I think it's very important that we talk about marriage in a lot of ways. And by doing that, I'll use the great Pope John Paul II. I'm going to try to walk in Father Thomas Loya's footsteps in throwing my two cents into the theology of the body narratives or explanations, as it were. It's a very powerful part of thinking about life and thinking about marriage, thinking about the Catholic Church, thinking about the meaning of existence and all the rest of the things. And even though I slipped in that Catholic Church, it's something obviously universal. Doesn't just affect studying the theology of the body by Pope John Paul II should not be reserved just for those who consider themselves Catholic or those who are Catholic. I think a lot of young people, even let us say Catholics who either go to church sometimes or even all the time or at least Christers of sorts or baptism, weddings, and funeral type churchgoers, especially when they fall in love with somebody who's not Catholic, especially if that somebody has had a previous marriage and they certainly don't want to go through an annulment, the Catholic person sort of gives up the idea of getting married in a Catholic church as a kind of... act of love for the person. I'm not going to drag you into my church, which has these things that I don't understand, you don't understand, nobody understands, blah, blah, blah. And in order to smooth out, in order to avoid any bumps in the road, to avoid any possible conflicting ideas about marriage, we won't do a, I won't insist on getting married in a Catholic church. I think that's, it's a basic thing for a lot of young people today. So it is. Let us dive into, we'll come to these other practical matters, but I think the best way to spend our time, that's a good
beginning. You just wrinkled my brain, man.
The best way to spend our time here on this wonderful hour of the winds change is to reap some of the really wonderful insights that John Paul II gives to us about marriage and his theology of the body. Hopefully it will open a person's heart and mind to realizing this is even more significant. This what we do, joining together, is even more significant than what we previously thought. And we have previously thought that it was very significant. bringing God into a marriage makes it. Shouldn't scare people. I guess it does, because it challenges sort of a more. Yeah, that's part of it. it challenges a more animalistic understanding, or just naturalistic, without any supernatural flair to it, as it were. So, anyways. I'm going to start off with an episode in the Theology of the Body, which John Paul II focuses on calling original solitude. Original solitude. There's a few different originals that John Paul II alludes to when he's trying to analyze the story of Adam and Eve from the book of Genesis. Of course, we may be familiar with the idea of original innocence, i.e. the kind of life that man and woman had in the Garden of Eden before original sin. That is key, and that does play a significant part. But he also brings in this concept of original solitude, which is a little bit more mysterious, even though original innocence is quite mysterious as well. So what we're going to do is try to analyze what he means by original solitude and how it should help us really make better marriage bonds when people do fall in love and give themselves to each other in that bond of marriage, and it elevates it in a very, very real way. If you happen to get my flock note, what I send out, My theme today was the theology of the body in light of how many people just don't get it. And I'm particularly thinking of an archbishop in Rome by the name of Paglia. There's a archbishop in Rome, Bishop Paglia, and he is now the new director of a new, rebooted, refashioned, remade John Paul II Institute. Maybe you've heard of this. It's kind of a story that's been unfolding over about a year now or so. And it's when I read about this, and when I read what some of the folks who are involved in it are saying, I just can't help but say to myself, and I say to you who are listening today, they just don't get John Paul II's theology of the body. They think they do, but it's so clear they don't. And in some ways, I get very mad at these folks because it is such beautiful teaching. And yet I can't be too mad at them because it's very challenging to grasp. It is a truth that has eluded most people. And I could even confess that it eluded me and my heart and mind for a while, until the light goes on, until that certain something clicks and you say, this truth is fundamental, this truth is incredibly important. And that opens the door to the reward room. And indeed, as we think about our reward room here, Nick, our my man here, he controls these two doors on both sides of the studio here. One is the punishment room, which we do use every now and then. And as a matter of fact, if you're a faithful listener to the Winds of Change, I put myself in the punishment room a few weeks back. Oh, sorry to say, but that's only because we want great standards.
My Lord,
and we are
such destruction.
Well, that destroys the good professional radio show that we are when one of us makes a mistake and we have to go into the punishment room. But the reward room was also added afterwards because we said, well, we should not just have a punishment room, we should have a reward room too. And whenever we think in terms of reward, in terms of religion and theology and God, we must consider what heaven is to open our minds to understand more deeply what heaven truly is, and not just what we imagine it to be, what we would like it to be, but what heaven truly is, especially as we build the pieces of that vision on solid logic, on solid biblical foundations, on a true understanding of what love is and unity is and eternity is and all these wonderful things. So that's one of the beauties of trying to understand marriage and the theology of the body, the proper use of the body that teaches us about God. That's the key insight of John Paul II, that without reading theology books, man and woman who certainly read each other, you try to read each other's actions, you try to read each other's words, and John Paul says, don't forget, read the sexual activity. Read what our sexual activity is saying, is conveying. And if you're sincere and you're honest and you reach that deeper sense of true love, you begin to see God. And that's why even the most uncatechized young romantic lovers have a sense of, well, God is love. And therefore, if we have love, then we have God. In a very mistaken way, they'd say if we love each other, then we have enough of God, and then we don't need religion. Since we have enough God between the two of us, we don't need to mess it up with the church folks and going to church and all that means. So, but. I gotta share a couple things about how I think I'm using Archbishop Paglia as kind of a poster boy of those who don't get it, but there's quite a few. I'm frustrated with a lot of these leaders because they sort of give the impression that they understand what Pope John Paul II taught and said, and now they're dismissing it. But in their other words, in their reactions, in their especially who they promote and who they disdain, it's just evident that they don't get it, as it were. And so, as a matter of fact, here is one of the. I'm reading from a very interesting book by José Antonio Urreta, and the title is called "Paradigm Shift." And he's kind of bringing to light a number of the issues that have happened in the past. Well, 5 years since Pope Francis has been our pope, And in the last year, this remaking of the Pope John Paul II Institute is not an insignificant story. It's certainly significant. One little detail about Archbishop Paglia is the fact that he's an admirer of Marco Pannella. Marco Pannella, and that name probably doesn't mean much to us here in the United States, but if you were in Italy, you might know that name a little bit more. Pannella was pretty big in Italian politics. He was a leader in Italy's radical party, which championed the fight to legalize divorce, contraception, in vitro fertilization, abortion, euthanasia, and of course, same-sex civil unions. So it's a very strange bedfellow. As a matter of fact, the one little detail that shows the connection between Bishop Paglia and Marco Pannella.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah.
You just wrinkled my brain, man.
Well, it's gonna get more wrinkled, I'm sorry to say. Let me finish before we take a break. Here's a little sidebar, which shows the admiration of Pannella by Paglia, bishop to this political type fellow in Italy. The bishop phoned him, Archbishop Paglia, the president of the Pontifical Academy of Life, when Pannella died, he stated that it was a great loss for our country, since he was the inspirer of a more beautiful life, not only for Italy, but for our world, which needs more than ever men who can speak like him. That's a strange thing to say for a politician who is fighting for, not only just accepting and tolerating, but really pushing for that list of, all we could say is that they're a list of sins that have always been considered sinful and are injurious to matrimonial life. What is injurious to matrimonial life is injurious to family life. What is injurious to family life is injurious to society. You get the picture. So, lest we just stay on the negative side, I want to, or after we take a break, we're going to dive into John Paul II and see a beautiful insight about original solitude, which should help us understand and get it. You see what I'm saying, my friends? Stay tuned. I'm Father Tom Coyes. You're listening to Listener Supported, The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
Will you say yes? Our Lady is looking for patrons. In 1999, the Blessed Mother asked the St. Stanislaus Kostka Parish, open the doors. And so we did. St. Stanislaus Kostka Parish is now open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, providing all people a place of prayer, a quiet sanctuary from the noise of the world to adore the living God and hear His voice. In 2007, Francis Cardinal George designated St. Stanislaus Kostka the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy for Chicago. Since that time, we have been faithful to the call to be a place of spiritual sanctuary for those seeking God and His mercy. The cost of keeping our doors open 24 hours a day is considerable, to say nothing of the cost of maintaining this beautiful and historic church in the heart of Chicago. We are asking you to consider becoming a patron of the Blessed Mother, promising God and the Blessed Mother a weekly donation of $20 or more for at least 1 year to support the call to open the doors. As a patron, you will know that you have answered Our Lady's call to keep the doors open and be remembered at patrons' masses on the second Sunday of the month at St. Stanislaus Kostka, the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy. Will you accept Our Lady's invitation and join the patrons of the Blessed Mother? Go to ststandschurch.org. That's ststandschurch.org and click on the Donations tab and click Patron on the drop-down. God bless you.
The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
St. Stanislaus Kostka Church is the official sanctuary of the Divine Mercy in Chicago. Founded by Polish immigrants in the late 1800s, this historic church is more commonly known as St. Stan's. One church, many cultures, in that masses are held in English, Spanish, and Polish. The church is two blocks north of Division on Noble, just off the Kennedy. St. Stan's has been so prominent in the history of the church in Chicago that the Kennedy Expressway was even built around it. St. Stan's is easy to get to. It is the sanctuary for quiet prayer before the celebrated iconic monstrance. For Mass and confession times and special events, please visit our new website at ststandschurch.org. That's ststandschurch.org. And while you're on the homepage, feel free to click on the Donations tab to help in the continuing restoration of St. Stan's.
Hey, welcome back, everyone. God bless you for tuning in. I'm doing a little something different today on The Winds of Change. Instead of trying to discuss American history and our Catholic faith in that incredible story we call America, which is often my favorite theme. Another one of my favorite themes is marriage and the beautiful lessons that John Paul II gives us in his writings called The Theology of the Body. Many of you know and probably love Father Thomas Loyer, who does this so well. And I'm putting in my two cents here today, as it were. It's such a vast subject. You got to chop it up and try to attack it in little pieces. So it's all about trying to reap the most wisdom that is possible from the scriptural story of Adam and Eve in the book of Genesis, as well as how our Lord Jesus in the Gospels refers to the story of Adam and Eve as the apostles question Jesus about marriage, primarily about is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife, and even the statements about lust in your eyes, where the apostles say, well, if lusting after a woman in your eyes is equivalent to adultery, then it's better not to get married. Remember those kinds of episodes in the Gospels. Jesus then tosses our mind back to the beginning, the original way that God established creation. that's called the original innocence, and it involves what we in catechesis and theology call the preternatural goods, the way God made us in the beginning of time before original sin took hold or destroyed that beautiful Garden of Eden. And it's very important, my friends, to realize and have in your mind that that is not just a mythical story, that it really does have historical foundation. And it's very important to believe that, because if we don't believe that, then all the problems that we do discover in human nature and in nature itself, we know there is evil inclinations within many people. You could almost say everyone, but in some people, the evil inclinations are terribly strong, take over a person. But the vast majority of us have good inclinations and bad inclinations, and to rejoice with our good ones and to struggle with our bad inclinations is just a mature attitude in life. So if you discover that there are imperfections in human nature and you don't believe that God created the world wonderfully and beautifully in the Garden of Eden, that he really did start human life off in a paradise type way, then you will have to believe that from the get-go we had these imperfections and ailments, diseases, as it were. And then of course, you have to blame God. You have to blame God for them. Because if they're not our fault and they're part of the way we're made, then they're God's fault. I like to liken it to, sometimes we get into arguments about who makes a better car, you know, Chevy or Ford or Toyota, things like that. And obviously the engineers that work for Ford are going to say Ford's cars are the best. The engineers and the people who buy them, those who work for Chevy will say the Chevy and the Toyota. I guess you could say, you can also use this example with computers, right? We also argue about computers, who makes the best computers these days. But anyways, when you find a radical problem with the hardware or with the machine itself, and it's not a software problem or an operational problem, your car smashes into a wall because you weren't looking, you're not going to blame the engineers of the Ford you're driving. But if you're driving along just perfectly fine and your engine starts on fire, you will quickly blame something about the maker, right? Who made this car? I'm never going to buy one of these again, et cetera, et cetera. So it's very important to have a realistic appreciation of how God made the world at the beginning of time. In other words, it was paradise. Didn't have the problems we all know and can see now. So we got this sense of innocence, original innocence, where there's no sin. But in John Paul's analysis, he stumbles on another aspect of that original time called original solitude. So if by chance you take note of these kinds of things, whenever someone's analyzing or studying John Paul II's Theology of the Body, we often make reference to the day that he gave the lecture on those Wednesday audiences. And this was from October 10th, 1979. Okay, and so he's going to go into the meaning of original solitude. He says here, the problem of solitude shows itself only in the context of the second account of the creation of man. The first account does not mention this problem. Now, what's he talking about? The problem. Why is solitude a problem? Well, it's a problem for Adam when God recognizes that Adam feels lonely, so that he's by himself and he's feeling lonely. Therefore, that solitude is a problem. And John Paul is trying to help us understand that when you study Scripture and you study the story of Adam and Eve, it's very important to recognize there's two stories of the creation of man. The first one from Genesis 1, and the second one, logically, in Genesis 2. So you got the first story in Genesis 1 where God created the sun and the moon, the stars and the angels, and the and clouds and all that. This six day he created man, male and female, he created them. You got that? And then he rests on the seventh day. So in that first story of creation, which is referred to as the Eloist tradition, because the word Elohim is used for God in that little chapter, and the second creation story is about the one we know of. Adam is goes to sleep, and God takes his rib and makes woman out of him. That's called the Yahwist tradition, which is really older than the Elohist tradition. And so he's just referring to this development of doctrine, I guess you could call it, as evidence in the early primitive world, the people believing in God, the one God, and how it does make a sense a little bit that the topic of being feeling alone would be more primitive than a creator of the universe. It just seems that way. When you're a teenager, the sense of being alone, when you're a young person, the idea of not having your lifetime partner is very much in your mind, in your face, occupying your time before you lay down and contemplate the origins of the universe and how God made the sun and the stars and the earth and all the rest. There's this problem we find in the second account where Adam falls asleep and God takes the rib, makes woman. In the second account, which, as we have already mentioned, speaks first about the creation of man and only afterwards about the creation of woman, this concentrates our attention on the fact that man is alone. And this turns out to be a fundamental anthropological issue that is in some way prior to the issue raised by the fact that man is male and female. This issue is prior not only in the chronological sense, but rather in the existential sense. See what he's doing? He's trying to imagine Adam walking around in the garden. He's doing his job. He's tending his garden, cultivating the earth, making those canals. There's a little reference in the Bible about him making irrigation canals. So there's Adam, but then we find that he's lonely. He's feeling a sense of solitude. This is how the issue of man's solitude will appear from the point of view of the theology of the body, if we are able to carry out a deeper analysis of the second creation account in Genesis 2. So this is all Jean Paul II's introduction. It's his warm-up, as it were. And I don't want us to miss one of a beautiful insight that has helped me a lot, and I hope I try to help couples as well when they want to know and love God even better and strengthen their bonds between each other and the best marriage that they can have. Anyway, so stay tuned, my friends. Let's take another quick break. I'm Father Tom Coys. You're listening to listener-supported The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
St. Stanislaus Kostka is the sanctuary of the divine mercy, where you can enter into the presence of Christ 24/7. Every first Saturday afternoon will be a special opportunity for healing. At 4:30, bring your petitions for our Blessed Mother's intercession as we pray the rosary. Then, at 5, we share the body of Christ in the Holy Mass. Also, at 5:30, a Spanish Mass, followed by a Eucharistic procession, adoration, the Divine Mercy Chaplet, and an anointing. Enter into the sacred space of St. Stanislaus Kostka and place yourself before Christ for healing. On first Saturday afternoon, starting at 4:30, find St. Stanislaus Kostka, the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy, 2 blocks north of Division, on Noble, just off the Kennedy in Chicago, and find peace and healing.
The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
There is a lot going on at St. Stan's. St. Stanislaus Koska is the sanctuary of the Divine Mercy in Chicago. There is Eucharistic adoration before the iconic monstrance, confessions 4 days per week, and masses in English, Polish, and Spanish. There's much more waiting for you here. St. Stan's is right off the Kennedy Expressway, just 2 blocks north of Division on Noble. Find out more by going to ststanschurch.org. That's ststanschurch.org, and enter into the presence of Christ.
Hey, welcome back, everyone. God bless you for hanging in there with me today on the Winds of Change. I'm trying to unpack some of John Paul II's Theology of the Body, and I especially think it's important for us to spend some time thinking about these things because there's so many people who just don't get it, and there's an arrogance in a number of higher-up folks that are dissing John Paul II's Theology of the Body in a, I can't help but say, in sort of a immature way, in the sense that they're calling for a moving beyond what John Paul II said in order to get a more a deep, a more connected, a more full. Let's see. Here's a here's an interesting quote from, I think this is Paglia, where he says, when they're talking about the new remake of the John Paul II Institute in Rome, which had been quite prolific and successful at helping people understand the deeper and the wide-reaching areas of the teachings of John Paul II, especially because he defended the prohibition against artificial contraception. And by stating that as a objective moral evil, he just got a bad reputation, and people wouldn't want to follow him, rejecting his whole thing. And they were rejecting it by calling for kind of a more integral approach, or approach that understood the complexities of human life. But no one understands the complexities better than John Paul, I have to say, is what he's... here's what one of the articles says, that this new remake of the Institute, with a clear purpose of remaining faithful to the teaching of Christ... Well, that's... glad it's stated that way, but... is it, with a clear purpose to remaining faithful to the teaching of Christ, we must therefore look with the intellect of love and with wise realism at the reality of the family today in all its complexities, with its lights and its shadows. Okay, that's sort of a poetic statement of sorts. He's saying that we will keep to the teaching of John Paul II with the prohibition against artificial contraception, the acceptance of humani vitae, and yet so many of the people involved in the new institute are the very ones who are calling for legalized abortion, artificial contraception, same-sex marriage, and all these things. They just don't get it, that's not accepting the complexities of family life, and that's not with wise realism. Here's another little quote too, that I think this one is actually from Pope Francis himself, when he was interviewed. Let's see. Looks like an interview with Corriere della Sera. Well, there was a director of that magazine. And Pope Francis says, "I've never understood the expression non-negotiable values. Values are values, and that is enough. I cannot say that one of the fingers of a hand is less useful than another." Now, I don't know what he exactly means by that, but if he's having a hard time understanding the expression non-negotiables, I can help him understand what the term non-negotiable means by using his analogy of the fingers on a hand. He's trying to say we don't want one moral command or prohibition to be more important than other aspects of life, namely, like, well, what are the circumstances? What do I mean by this? What does it cost? What influences? All the other, we call them moral determinants in classical moral theology. Remember that, friends. In classical Catholic moral theology, we always should be trying to decipher the moral determinants, what determines the morality of an action. And for the modern mind, there's basically two. You could say there's circumstances that make something right or wrong, or there's motivation that makes something right or wrong. But by holding it only to two and leaving out the third classic determinant, you really are erasing. You're trying to play baseball without a ball and a bat. You're trying to play football without a football. You're removing yourself from the actual stuff of what you're talking about. Okay, what I'm getting at is the third moral determinant is the act itself. What is the act itself? And can we describe the act itself as good or evil, right or wrong? As I say, the modern mind has been kind of trained to think that no, there's no such thing as an absolute right or wrong. In terms of the act itself, there's only the circumstances and there's only the motivation, which has always struck me as such a silly, silly conclusion, because you're talking, if you say there's the only thing that matters is the circumstances and the motives, you could easily say, the circumstances of what? What are you putting in this circumstance? What is the it that is in the circumstances? Or if it's only the motive, what are you talking about that you are doing for this motive or that motive? There has to be that third leg of the tripod of moral determinants, the act itself. And so John Paul II and the Institute for John Paul II. Oh, that
you just wrinkled my brain, man.
Oh, well, good. That was a key point. I'm glad you were wrinkled right there. And so the John Paul II Institute focused on the act itself, especially if we're going to go deeper into the contraceptive issue. So that act itself needs to be considered wrong, evil in itself, regardless of motivation or circumstances. And the new worldly way of doing theology would be to deny that acts in themselves can be declared good or evil. So, anyways, I can't help but get into that because that's the meat of the issue. But the beauty of original solitude has an important lesson. So let's this has helped me as a priest, and I know in it. Definitely can and should help people who are married. And that is the way Pope John Paul II discovers that Adam, before Eve, felt lonely in the garden. There's a certain surprise on the part of God, is how John Paul II puts it. He takes a pause. It's almost as if when God realizes that Adam is lonely, there's a little pause in the sense of, almost a disappointment on God's part by saying, what do you mean you're lonely? I'm here with you in the garden. How could you be lonely when I'm with you? And but God sort of overcomes that right away and realizes, hey, wait a minute. I'm God. I don't have a body like he does. He needs someone to love like him. That's the little phrase in the Bible, of course. I'm going to make him a helpmate, someone like him. And so God sort of catches himself. I call it God's moment of how do I call it? The mommy, the empty crib syndrome of a mother. We'll call it that. In the sense that a mother, when she has her baby, looks at her little infant, and those of you who are mothers out there, and those of you who have had children, and those of you who had nursed and held and loved your little baby, know much better about what I'm talking, but I'll just refer to it, and you can either shake your head or say I'm crazy, but I don't think I am. the mother who loves the baby with all her heart, soul, and mind is like God loving Adam in the Garden of Eden. As the child grows, and the child, of course, does love his or her mother, right? But eventually we all know that that child, as they grow, is going to start saying to him or herself, I want love in my life. And the mother could sort of say, you have me. What do you need further? Aren't I providing all the love you need? And of course, the young boy or girl says, no, but I want someone like me. And what he means by that is not that the mother is of a different species or something, but that someone is someone he can bond to and couple with in a way that you wouldn't do with your own parents, obviously. You form your own marriage. And so there's a little point in the story of Adam and Eve where God is sort of like the mother who's saying, aren't I enough for you? And that aren't I enough for you is where original solitude can take on a beautiful meaning instead of a sad, troublesome meaning. We're going to get back to that as soon as we take another break here, okay? So let's stay tuned, my friends. Hang with me, and I know you'll be blessed as I've been to gain insights from John Paul II. I'm Father Tom Kois, sitting in for Father Anthony Bush. You're listening to listener-supported The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
St. Stan's School has an amazing PK 3 through 8th grade program focused on leadership and social-emotional learning, and is one of the only schools to implement the Reading and Writing Project of Columbia University and the University of Chicago. Everyday math across the board, PK 3 through 8th, is taught by our highly educated and dedicated teachers. St. Stan's students are academically challenged with advanced level placement opportunities as their test scores and high school admissions speak volumes. St. Stan's is an integral part of the Wicker Park community, where you feel welcome and at home with other families and friends who enjoy the same warm, friendly, and safe atmosphere for their children. We have small classroom size, which makes a difference in the whole learning experience. Many schools have excellent programs. At St. Stan's, we empower students to be excellent. Join the St. Stan's family. It is a selective admissions process. Grades 1 through 8 are tested and interviewed. Call 773-278-4560. That's 773-278-4560. or stop by at 1255 North Noble Street. That's one block north of Division, just off the Kennedy. More information at ststandschicago.org. That's ststandschicago.org.
The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
There is a lot going on at St. Stan's. St. Stanislaus Kostka is the sanctuary of the Divine Mercy in Chicago. There is Eucharistic adoration before the iconic monstrance, confessions 4 days per week, and masses in English, Polish, and Spanish. There's much more waiting for you here. St. Stan's is right off the Kennedy Expressway, just two blocks north of Division on Noble. Find out more by going to ststandschurch.org. That's ststandschurch.org, and enter into the presence of Christ.
Hey, welcome back, folks. Father Tom Coyce here with you. I left you with this. We're in the beginning of the Bible, and we're trying to analyze Adam before Eve was created, and God is sort of content with what He made, who He made. But he finds that Adam is lonely, and this is the insight that is earth-shattering, I believe. John Paul II wants us to realize that not only is this a reference to a young man who's lonely without his girlfriend or wife, it's not only in the sense of human romance and how human romance does take away a loneliness because Adam is a word that is referencing not just to the individual boy man but it's also a word representing the human race, all of us. So it's very important for us to catch that nuance of the word Adam as person, just human being. And so John Paul wisely points out that loneliness before the other is created is not only true for boy and girl, but it's also true for man himself. And so, therefore, there is a kind of loneliness that is not taken away from us with the coming into a human marriage situation. There was a bond between God and Adam, and Adam was not. Adam was able to talk to God, was able to communicate with God. He had everything when he had God, except he didn't have a creature like himself. And so there's that loneliness that is overcome by the creation of Eve. But as God steps back and says, okay, I'm going to give you one like yourself to love, in a sense, God then steps back and gets hidden by Eve. And the insight of John Paul II, and this is what all married couples have to realize, is that even us together can be lonely, in the sense that us together can be without God. That's why getting married has to be done in a religious context. Getting married has to be done in church. And our Catholic Church is the only one that's really pushing this sacramental aspect of the boy and the girl coming together. Because yes, it will alleviate a certain kind of loneliness. And I think most married couples, it's kind of funny how so many there's two kinds of reactions at the weddings that I of course am at, because I'm at a lot of weddings. Being a priest, it's part of our job. It's one of the wonderful parts of our job, even though it can be a lot of headaches, as you might have guessed. But anyways, there's two kinds of, there's the oh, how wonderful, you know, and God bless you, and be, we hope you endless years of happiness and joy and all the rest. And then there's often a bit of a cynical kind of approach. Well, they're happy now, but wait for a while, you know. Or there's a sense, especially if older people themselves have gone through the breakup and everything. Yeah, it's nice while you're on the honeymoon, but wait until reality sinks in. There's that kind of reaction to weddings, of course. But the beauty of discovering original solitude as not a problem is what all of us have to capture. And you could see how it would help me as a priest say that my love for God has to be so strong and powerful that it allows me to walk through life without the anxiety of not having the other. That's why these calls for married priests today, I think, it's understandable. We know the sense of Adam without Eve, and we say, oh, it's so very sad that the man priest would not have his helpmate in his own Eve. And of course, I would imagine a lot of priests do go through that, and they sense, oh, make me an Eve, Lord. And so that's the spirit behind the priest get married movement. But John Paul's saying, no, there, that original solitude, which allows us access into the heart of God himself, it sort of requires a certain original solitude. So there's two things that married couples have to appreciate, is that there is a loneliness and there's an emptiness that your spouse cannot cure you of. You know what I'm saying? Does that make sense? There's an emptiness, there's a loneliness that even a wonderful spouse cannot cure you of.
Wow.
Now, you might...
You just wrinkled my brain, man.
That is definitely brain ring. You might fool yourself to say, I don't need God. I'm completely fulfilled with my spouse. But you're fooling yourselves, because your spouse can't give you the eternity and the perfection that only God really can give. And so couples have to realize that emptiness can only be filled by Almighty God and not the other. And us priests have to realize that the taking away of the Eve, the taking away of the human spouse, allows us to realize that a spousal relationship with God himself is possible. And that just blows your mind completely to think of what in the world that is. We don't know what it is, but it's in the Bible, in the beautiful teachings of the wedding feast of the Lamb. I always like to point people to the wedding feast of the Lamb as the ending of the Bible, and it's an ultimate goal of our life, and it truly is an essential part of our meaning and our happiness. So anyways, don't be afraid of that loneliness that only God can take away. Run to God and let God be that wherever you are in life. God love you for listening to The Winds of Change. This is Father Tom Coyes. You've been listening to listener-supported The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
What's there to say when the world makes no sense? Do we search deep or true?